encouraged, not burdened by the history that they create. They know what is expected of them. They are Manchester United.
Welcome, listeners, to another episode of the Fergie Fledglings podcast. We are back after a hiatus of, summer things going on. But we're here right at the start of Manchester United's preseason. And I'm joined today by Polly Questel. Polly, how's it going?
It's going well. I'm almost not ready for this, for United to be coming back.
Yeah, so the day that they played Leeds, by the way, they beat Leeds in a friendly 2-0 in Oslo. That was 38 days exactly since the FA Cup final.
It's not a lot of time.
No, it really isn't. And it's even less time when you think that, like, in less than a month is when the Premier League starts back up.
Yeah, and how quickly did the players come back from... How quickly did the players come back?
So,
the international players came back on Sunday, but so,
yeah, several
so
of them.
That? 38 plus what, four? So 42 days after the FA Cup final, except they all played internationally. So what they get, like 3 weeks of a break?
Something like that.
And because of the culture, like, you are massively praised for showing up early and not taking all the time off, which is ironic because in England and Europe they like very much value time. It's like an American appreciation of, oh, you're giving more time to the company and you're coming back early and you're in early. And that's the mindset of all the fans and the media of, like, let's praise this guy, he showed up early. But it exists even in a country where the mindset of the worker is like, nope, take your time off. And like, and even of the companies, like, we respect time. I mean, Europe doesn't work in August. They all go on vacation for the month of August because they,
except for Premier League players who now,
right, through, who don't get off Christmas, by the way.
Yeah. And like through the art of corporate networking, basically now have to play tournaments against MLS teams for the foreseeable future in the month of August.
Yeah, but that's also been a thing for like 10 years now.
Right. It's like, I guess there was times when like Everton and West Ham would come over as well, but it seems like,
well, there is, I mean, there's the whole Premier League in August series, which is just like the teams that aren't attracted to these big name things. Like the International Champions Cup doesn't exist anymore. Maybe the name branding is still there, but like it used to actually be a tournament that you won and lifted a trophy in.
Yeah. Not as cool as the gaming PC trophy the United collected in Bangkok last year.
Right. But so the teams that don't attract that, like Brighton and I think Newcastle, like they're now just getting a Premier League to where it's just Premier League branded to go and, hey, take our games to Red Bull Arena and other cities throughout the country.
Yeah. I think they can thank NBC for that because they've really taken advantage of the like mini festivals in cities for, you know, random game weekends.
Yeah, but this is just shameless promotion,
right,
et cetera, as opposed to going on tour and playing and playing the local team, as United have done several times. They've played the LA Galaxy, they've played teams or playing teams. Yeah, like, I mean, look, we're talking a big game here. Like, United are about to play Arsenal. That there's nothing special about that game. But right, like United playing Celtic in Toronto, like they don't play Celtic all the time. You know, taking things like that around, like Borussia Dortmund. I could see the value in those. It's shameless promotion when you're just playing Arsenal and yeah, whatnot. But it's also kind of necessary in a way.
Yeah, it's not like it used because they used to just like, they would go to Portugal and they would find a nice place and then they would play like some of the, you know, Liga B teams in the area or like an amateur side for a behind closed doors friendly, something like that. Which Bayern Munich did today, and they annihilated some.
They won like 34-0, and Dortmund the other day won like 12-0.
Yeah,
they used to play, they used to go to Singapore and play like a Singapore 11, and eventually, like, and Sir Alex Ferguson mentioned this, like, he was just like, I realized, like, we're not gaining anything from that. We're not building our fitness. Like, we need to play better teams. And then all the big teams sort of banded together, and it works, and it's good. But also sometimes, like, unnecessary. Like, what is the team going to look like on Saturday when they play Arsenal? It's just like, now with Ten Hag, you'll probably get the starting 11 for entirely too long of that match. But like,
we need to give Declan Rice a proper intro to our life at Arsenal in the 20 minutes but of also the first, like, half that he plays.
Know, if you're just throwing the, you know, like, last Tuesday's game against Leeds was like a nice chance for a bunch of youngsters to throw on the first team United shirt, wear their squad number as high as they are, and play in front of Erik ten Hag. It was not Manchester United versus Leeds. And Manchester United doesn't gain anything out of that match. And as well as players played, you have to take it with that grain of salt of like, okay, yeah, but they didn't play against Leeds' first team either, and like, they played against a lot of Leeds' reserves, and it's like, you're still not playing against men, you're still not playing against like the Premier League side. You have to take shirts out of the question here and solely look at the name on the back. So I guess the all-encompassing thing is like, yeah, it's nice to play these big teams, but it only matters if you're playing against their guys. If you throw 45 minutes of your first team against 45 minutes of Arsenal's first team, that's a meaningful exercise. If either one of those teams is just like, we're putting in a lot of academy players, or in the years where like it's a World Cup and the players are late and it is a lot of academy players, like, it's all useless. Which goes back to the player showing up on like no break whatsoever, and now it's like, we got to play you into shape. How did you have enough time to fall out of shape?
Right. I mean, even on vacation, I mean, we saw like Maguire and Dallo were training for 2 weeks in Portugal together. Marcus Rashford was going through sessions in New York. I mean, they don't stop working towards, you know, maintaining their fitness and getting in shape. It's just, you know, hopefully they got that little bit of a break mentally that they would have needed after, you know, a really longer than expected, maybe some thought season, where a lot of the first team had to play pretty much every game. So
yeah, and even if you're not playing it, I mean, it's very important. Everybody has talked about this in multiple occasions. It's so important. 10 to 14 days, you just have to shut it off. You unplug and you don't think about football. And I don't know if, like, obviously these are professional athletes, they're people that are addicted to staying in shape to begin with. So you're obviously going to work out, though I don't know if that's meant, you know, what are you working out for to make sure your fitness levels don't drop? Why? For football. So is it completely out of the question, out of your mind? I don't know. Maybe. But that 10 to 14 day break, as crucial as it is not giving you the physical break. And as you just said, a long season, very long, World Cup in the middle, coming off of years of condensed schedules. And now we're entering pretty much the last regular season we're gonna get. Regular goes into air quotes. Leads into a tournament, so we're right back at it. There's a Copa America, there's a Euros next year, so everybody involved. And then we're coming back to a season where the Champions League is going to be longer. We're gonna play 10 group stage games, I believe. Mm-hmm. And the League Cup is still going to exist. The FA Cup will still be there. The Nations League will be taking place. World Cup qualifying may or may not start by then. But like in the summer, the Nations League is still going to be there. There's still an international break window in that June. And also at the end of the summer, there is a 32-team club World Cup. Now, Manchester United are not going to be involved in that, and they can't be involved in that. So that's kind of nice for us. But
unless we win the Champions League this year, Holly.
I think if we win the Champions League this year, I think it's already set.
Oh, we missed the cutoff.
We would qualify for the next World Cup. So for some teams, it's like at some point players are going to start dropping. No.
Yeah. I mean, look, you just went through all that, this like football never ends cycle, which I think more and more people are becoming, you know, vocally aware of. And perhaps things will happen to change that. But as of now, money is the significant driver. The football bubble has not burst yet, and I'm not sure if it will.
And they're playing an exorbitant amount of preseason games this year. And now I get the reason you're doing that. You're doing that so that I can see everybody, so that I can put 11 players out there for 90 minutes, and then tomorrow night when we come back, because they play like Real Madrid and somebody else on back-to-back nights, and it's like, and then I could put a different 11 out there and see them for 90 minutes, and there's merit to that. There's also, like, it used to be you played less preseason games and you built your starters' fitness levels up, but you still got them off the pitch because you had to see other players. So maybe they played 90 minutes once out of however many games, if that, or you kind of do it like in the NFL where they, you know, you get them to, like, you play your starters for three quarters in one of these games, and then they don't play a full game until week one of the regular season. But now you're going to build them up and still have one or two games where they play 90 minutes. And it's just like, that's not necessary.
In the NFL, we call that the week three preseason game, but there's like four or five of them. Anyway, though, we need to get into the other pertinent Manchester United topics. First of which, it's old news now because it happened last week. But David De Gea, the number one for 12 years, has left Manchester United. He has not signed with another club yet, and it will be very interesting to see what the interest is there. But Erik ten Hag, it seems, you know, according to reports, very involved in the decision to, in a sense, withdraw from contract talks with David De Gea that were ongoing with the club. Lori Whitwell reported that David De Gea had a verbal agreement and potentially even had signed something that would have, you know, kept him at Man United for a few more years on reduced wages. And as after the season had ended and he left, to go on vacation, he got married, United kind of pull a 180, wanting to re-enter negotiations, withdrawing their former offer entirely. And the result now is they are signing Andre Onana for about 50 million euros plus five in add-ons. He is on his way to Manchester tomorrow, I believe, to complete a medical. I guess I don't know whether to start this conversation, Polly, with sort of the sentimentality around De Gea, or whether we should just dive into, you know, the meat of this, which is De Gea was obviously not good enough anymore, and now Erik ten Hag has a goalkeeper who could be transformative for the back line.
Yeah, that's the bit. Look, United are a bunch of missing pieces away. They were never one player away. We talked about this plenty of times. Like, when people said, sign Harry Kane, he could be like the Van Persie signing. And it was like, no, they're not one player away. They're not one midfielder away. They're not one striker away. They're not a right back away. But goalkeeper was the position that could make the biggest, most instantaneous impact. And they've addressed that. Is there were deficient? I mean, De Gea's shot stopping was his claim to fame, and it has gone down in the last few years. He's not proactive with the ball. He doesn't play with the ball at his feet. It's something that Erik ten Hag wants. That's sort of the modern game, is everybody's got to play with the ball at their feet. Remember when City signed John Stones for $50 million and everybody's like, why are they doing that? He's terrible. He can't defend. And it was like, they're not signing him for his defending. They're signing him because he could play with the ball at his feet. And that's when we harp on Ronaldo for not defending. It's because defending starts at the front. Attack starts at the back. That's the way that modern football works. All 11 players are involved in both. The situation was handled terribly. I think that's fair to say. You know, like, why not just, you can't come out and publicly say, I think it's difficult to publicly say it, but you could have probably said it at the end of the year, like before his final game at Old Trafford, to let him get that walk off. They were,
for a Wembley final.
If you just said anything, I didn't hear it at all.
Oh, sorry. I was joking, like with Van der Sar or with Schmeichel, you could give him the armband for the last game in a cup final.
Yeah, there's a lot of things that they could have done. The fact that Ten Hag went down to the wire saying we want him to stay, et cetera. That's an element of managing, is you don't want to throw your current player under the bus. He knows he's got to ride him the rest of the season. So you talk him up, you talk highly of him. And it's the fact that it leaked that he had this agreement and that everybody freaked out about it, but then the fact that it leaked and then that they leaked, oh, we had an agreement, De Gea even signed it, and United then pulled that agreement. Like, that all comes off poorly. It does. There's no way to deny that.
Even though it is the correct decision.
It's the correct decision, for sure. And yeah. But the way that the club handled it, very poor. Shame on them.
And it doesn't look great. There is the sense of, like, you shouldn't treat a respected and good servant player that way. I was a little worried as well about, you know, the club and where they were with Erik ten Hag in terms of being on the same page about summer recruitment. It seems like obviously the plans have undergone, you know, a pretty dramatic shift from what we were hearing going into the summer. It seemed like, you know, the Mason Mount opportunity kind of sprang up in May and they pounced on that. And then after that, we kept hearing the goal was going to be to sign a striker. They, with the funds spent on Mount and Onana, they could have, you know, spent all of that on Harry Kane with the money that's being quoted. It seems like they've taken the more sensible route, and Erik ten Hag had a hand in that, which is positive, but also, you know, kind of doing all of that on the fly was, you know, playing dangerously to some extent. Sorry.
But that's because you're taking everything at face value. Because who's putting those stories out there? I can tell you who's not doing it. And that's the club. And whenever a player gets linked with United, it's always coming from the player side. And sometimes, and again, it's well reported. If a reporter works their contact at United, because they have contacts there, and they say, oh, I heard from so-and-so's agent so-and-so's looking for a move. I heard you're interested. That you're interested. Whatever it is. United don't deny that. They don't deny the rumors. So, because they can't. They're linked to hundreds of players every single window because every agent just goes, oh, United, they're interested. Because if they get in contact with Manchester United, they say, oh, my client's looking for a move. Like, he'd be willing to come to United. He's very affordable, whatnot. Like, you know, the club are looking for £10 million. £50 million, and United respond, thanks, keep us abreast of the situation. That's it. Then you run to the paper and you go, United are interested. And then you use that to drive to get the move that you're looking for, or drive up your client's contract and get a new one and get higher wages. And if you call and confirm this with United, they're not going to deny it, because if they start denying it, then it's easy, you know, oh, they denied that one, but not that one. Every report is always just going to come out, and we we've seen it like clockwork. Every March international break, they get linked with Harry Kane. And I just kept being like, I'm not believing these stories because they're baseless. I'm just going to wait and see what happens. Like, I really try hard not to respond to any of these stories. Like, we've heard, oh, Newcastle, West Ham, they're all interested in Scott McTominay. What's happened there? Nothing. We've heard countless stories about Harry Maguire. What's happened there? Nothing. Fulham, super interested in Fred. Bid coming. Where's that bid? So it's all, the fact that they moved so quickly and so meticulously from, we went and got Mason Mount right away. There was partially because the opportunity was you had to do it in June because that's when Chelsea needed to sell, but they did not rush into it. You know, they drew it down to the wire as they should. Luckily, the wire there was June and not September. And they got a better deal on that. Then they went, okay, goalkeeper, Onana, he's the guy. I'm a little concerned that like Onana only popped up on everybody's radar after the Champions League final. And it's like, are we basing this on one game? I don't know, because I don't watch him play. But right. I like what I've seen out of him.
I mean, we could also base it off of, you know, the old assumption that Erik ten Hag knows who he is.
Yes. I did watch the Champions League final and it was like, yeah, the passes that he's spraying. Is going to be a huge asset to him. Can he keep the ball out of the net? I don't know. I'm fully prepared for United to sign this guy and we're all going to get really excited and he's going to have a Claudio Bravo season where it's like, yeah, great with his feet, could not stop the ball to save his life.
That can happen. Fabian Barthez 2.0.
Yeah. And then they moved on from that into the striker that they had always sort of had. Like, we had been hearing about Hojlund, whatever his name is. I'll learn it when they sign him. We'd been hearing about him for a while. Then there were the conflicting reports of like, oh, okay, like the price is very high. Where do you think that price is coming from? Like, you know, the club's not running to the press and saying, oh, this is the price that they quoted us. You know, when the club runs to the press, because it's always the same story and every single person tweets it out within 3 minutes of each other. You know, when they brief the press and it's always up, oh, we're ready to walk away from the deal.
Yeah,
I think it's meticulous. They've moved in a very meticulous way that makes me think this is actually very well planned. And this wasn't them. We're doing this on the fly. It also makes me believe like that, you know, perhaps Erik ten Hag did want Harry Kane and perhaps the recruitment side said, nah, we're not spending all that money on a 29-year-old. Here's the guy that does the things that you're looking to do. It's possible that you have a Jurgen Klopp and Liverpool situation or a Pep Guardiola and City situation where it's like, again, remember Pep, we spoke about this a few weeks ago. Pep wanted to sign Ilkay Gundogan. He was right down to the lat to on the pitch at the last cup final. And he was like, I hope this dude stays. I really want to resign him. And he kept saying that to the board. And the board was just like, yeah, no, he's 32. We're moving on from him. We're going to get somebody else in. Backing your manager does not mean throwing money at everybody that he wants, at every player that he wants. It means getting the right players for him and supplying him with a team that can win and saying, this is how you play. These are players that fit that style. We're going to go and you leave the actual players up to us because a coach is not a scout. And like you said, Mason Mount played in the Dutch league. He scored his first goal against Erik ten Hag. Onana played with ten Hag. What happens when you run out of players that ten Hag knows? What happens when you run it? What happens? Then it's just, oh, that guy scored against us. We should sign him. And it's like, ah, he had a good game. That doesn't, you know, you get into those dicey situations.
Right. You know, the commonly cited one on this podcast, Julian Brandt was a player Jurgen Klopp really wanted. And Mo Salah was kind of the alternative. I don't actually know if we've gotten to a situation where they've had to like seriously consider an alternative other than, I guess, Casemiro. when it came last summer, but you know, that's worked out
kind of a big one though.
Yeah,
it was kind of a big.
That was a pretty big one.
but like,
especially in terms of, I mean, United spending power this summer.
It's not just that. It's I wrote a mailbag on my Substack last week, and this was one of the questions I got was, what is Ten Hag trying to build? Because it or like the profiles of players that he's going for, because like, it does he have this plan? Because Frankie de Jong is such a different profile to Casemiro. And it's like, yeah, they're two completely different players. And the Casemiro signing kind of makes sense when you look and you go, well, we have a team with Anthony Martial, Jadon Sancho, and Marcus Rashford, and Bruno Fernandes. Highlight those last two. Really good counterattack team. And when you're going to play with Casemiro, that's going to play into that. You're going to sacrifice control. He's not a ball control guy. He's a ball winner. Move it up the field quick. I'll win the ball. I'll make that quick pass. Inside, like quick pass, once I win it back, Rashford, Bruno, they're going to run. Makes a lot of sense. Why would you sign Antony then? Because as you saw last year, Antony could not run on the counterattack at all. His need to slow down and put that ball on his left foot just killed attack after attack after attack. It was beyond frustrating to watch. So you sign Malacia, you sign Martinez, you sign Eriksen. All of those, no problem. No problem there. Then at the end of the day, you're still pushing for Frankie de Jong. Those players would fit. You don't get Frankie de Jong. So you go, all right, we're going to go with Casemiro. That's a change. That's like a shift in strategy. So it's like, okay, we're going in this direction now. But now you sign Antony, who's back in that first category where it's like, what are we doing here? And now you're bringing in some other guys who Mount would work in either situation. Onana, obviously, that's someone. I mean, look, you could play more. You could play counterattack and you could play more control and possession with Onana. That's not gonna change. And I don't think Hojlund changes that too much. But you're still just in this. I think the obvious goal is that you want to bring more control, more oomph into more of that possession style into the team.
But I think you still got
Casemiro. Like Casemiro, Mount, yeah, and Bruno are not going to be like a ball retention midfield,
right?
And like Antony's so, not going to be your counter attacker. So it's Rashford's not going to thrive in a ball retention, get it to him on the left wing and let him create for a striker sort of scenario. So there's still a lot of like, how is this all going to piece together? Question.
I think one of the big things, and this is kind of, you know, another Man United podcast, the Devils in the Details podcast, had a conversation about this in their episode that came out Monday with John McKenzie talking about rest defense and how, you know, Eric Ten Hag's setup is a lot more focused on, you know, last season addressing David De Gea's weaknesses. One of the ways that they had to do that was, how are we going to set up to prepare for, you know, eventual counterattacks when we turn the ball over? And I think Andre Onana will change that significantly. And I'm interested to see how this affects Rafael Varane. He might become the weak link.
Oh, he's already the weak link.
Yeah.
Which is so the thing about Varane is, and this was badly exposed last year, teams started doing the like, hey, let Varane have the ball thing. And he would carry it forward and then like basically throw his left foot behind the ball and like send it backwards towards Dolo or Juan Bissaka as soon as someone got close to it. He was afraid, you know, he's so uncomfortable with the ball that it will be frustrating to watch if you're trying to possess the ball more, if you're trying to get that build, because your buildup is kind of going to come from the back. It's going to come from Onana and your center backs and Luke Shaw, because they're not Mount's not a buildup guy. Casemiro's not, Bruno's not. Like you're sort of trying to like bypass, like have that first level be back to then play these line breaking passes towards these guys without having a midfielder having to come and do it. And Varane will quickly become the weak link. The thing about that, though, is that Varane is so good at all the other defensive, like as a pure defender, hard to get better than Rafael Varane. And that's the same thing with Juan Bissaka. As a pure defender, hard to get better. Like the fact that they just don't even give him help on the right side. They go, yeah. Like you watch the way Luke Shaw defends people and like the way that Lisandro Martinez is covering for him. And before that, the way Harry Maguire covered for him. And then you watch the right side and how Juan Bissaka's there and there's no coverage. Nobody covering for him because it's like, yeah, you're just going to shut him down by yourself. Like yeah. That's such an asset in the way you could use the rest of your players. But he's weak link. He's the weak link when they have the ball and it's like he becomes the trigger for the press. And Varane's the same situation and also Varane is extremely good at recovery defense versus, and that's what United did last year. It was so like they let teams get the ball into their own box willy-nilly. And then they went and they blocked passes and they blocked shots in there and they made clearances from there. And it's like in previous years, they just didn't let you bring the ball into the box. They prevented that, like instead of stopping shots, they prevented them. Instead of stop, like it was more about prevention than stopping. And
especially when they were playing against teams like City. Like that second sometimes. Game at Old Trafford, especially, I guess is the one I'm thinking of, where like you know the goal that happened was coincidentally
a mistake.
Because Wan-Bissaka was like, oh, Varane didn't shift with Haaland. I need to cover Haaland. The cross went to Grealish, who Wan-Bissaka was marking instead of Haaland.
And Fred slipped and like gave
right.
De Bruyne time to do that one time.
But apart from that,
and then the same thing happened in like the FA Cup where like Fred needlessly fouled him and obviously they scored on the set piece.
Apart from that, though, it was like City's highlights were blocked shots or Erling Haaland, you know, trying to create space and immediately Fred, who was
right, it was reminiscent
of getting in front of him.
It was reminiscent of previous wins over City, where against Liverpool, the win against Liverpool, they pretty much camped out in their own box and played so much in their own box. And then against City, they stepped up, they played higher up the pitch, and they prevented City from getting in the box, which is what they did to City years ago. So and not every time against. When Solskjaer beat them the first time at the Etihad, it was much lower. And it was a lot of defend the box, defending in the box and launching counterattacks from there. And when they won that game in the League Cup, the second leg where it wasn't enough to go through, that was like pretty much like the 2-1 against Liverpool, where City just pelted that goal the whole game and couldn't get the breakthrough. And then they came to Old Trafford, they got that 2-0 win where City couldn't even get close to the box. And similar at the Etihad when they won 2-0 the following year. And then this one. So like that's sort of what you want to do, but like that's not really Varane's specialty. Is he's not really that proactive defender. If you want to play,
he's losing.
If you want to play this high line,
yeah.
If you want to play this high line, like part of the whole thing about a high line is that when the other team hoofs the ball out, your center backs are right there to get it, control it, make a decisive pass right back in it, as opposed to when you drop lower, when your center backs come under fire, it's get the ball away and kind of hit it up the field. Because if everybody else is up the pitch, like, and you just hit it out and up, you give Rashford a chance to run it down and your attackers a chance to run it down and get on it and launch an attack. Like against Barcelona this year, the second half at the Nou Camp was entirely just, we're going to hoof it away. And like, Marcus, hopefully you get there.
I'm interested to see. I mean, one, what Ten Hag does at right back. It seems like, you know, he shifted in terms of his comfort for using Dalot eventually to Wan-Bissaka to end the year. I'm not sure how much of that was down to form as well as fitness, but it definitely seemed like Wan-Bissaka impressed him enough to keep that spot for the rest of the season once Dalot returned.
How many more starts at right back do you think Dalot made than Wan-Bissaka?
I mean, not that much more, because it was after the World Cup. It was pretty much all Wan-Bissaka the rest of the way, wasn't it?
He made 6 more starts than Wan-Bissaka at right back, which, considering that Wan-Bissaka like basically didn't play until January, is kind of astonishing.
Yeah, there was a stretch where Dalot kind of came back into the team for a little bit, but then they ended the year with
he did it as like a left back.
Yeah,
he played
like an inverted left back when Luke Shaw was out, and
he
scored that goal against Forest, which was, you know, if we could have gotten more of that, that would be fun. Because I think Dallo has the potential to be, you know, a little bit more of an asset in those areas where, you know, if they want to get creative in putting fullbacks into midfield areas in possession, I think that there's ways that he can be really useful. I just worry whether long term he's, you know, the player who can nail down that spot. As a lot of, I mean, pretty much all of us expected that he was going to do that last season, both for, you know, the fit that he was in Erik ten Hag's system, as well as, you know, what we saw from Aaron Wan-Bissaka in 21-22, where, you know, he had just lost all of the confidence that made him the defender that he was. And it seems like he's gotten that back, which is really important for somebody who is value is essentially sourced from his ability to defend.
Wan-Bissaka started 15 of United's last 18 matches. One of the ones that he didn't start was that dead rubber against Fulham on the final day of the season, where it was like, Dalot's going to play because Wan-Bissaka is going to play in the final. Yeah.
It's the only final player who got rest.
Yeah. He came on at halftime of the League Cup final, mm-hmm. but he did not retain his place. Dalot came back in there against West Ham, and then Dalot played against Liverpool in the drubbing, and then kept his play, and then started the match against Batiste, came off at halftime, Wan-Bissaka came on, and started 15 in the next 18.
Yeah.
So it sort of, and that this is something I wrote about, is if the split, Dalot just got a new contract. If the split is anything, it's unclear that Dalot is the top choice. It's mm-hmm. it's certainly clear that he fits this team better. He's better on the ball than Wan-Bissaka. But something happened where Ten Hag was like, I want Wan-Bissaka in there every week now, basically.
Yeah,
he overtook him.
I think Wan-Bissaka, like, to an extent, obviously he still had flaws in his game to end last season, but he did reward the trust of Ten Hag. You know, when we came back from the World Cup and Dalot was injured, there was serious concern over whether Wan-Bissaka could perform to the level that was needed. Yeah. And he answered it in that first game when he had that assist for Eriksen. Obviously, he didn't become the superstar fullback, enterprising forward creative player that, you know, people want from fullbacks nowadays, which is understandable.
His weakness is
a more fullback.
His weakness is on the ball.
Yeah.
And I think it's perceived as a little bit weaker than it actually is because he looks so clumsy on it. Yeah, is never fluid, and it makes him look worse than he is.
His first touch is also like sometimes he pulls a ball out of the air and you're like, how did he do that? And then other times it's like it goes 10 yards away from him.
Yeah. And he has that bit of McTominay in him where it looks like when he's about to play like a good ball, like he needs to kind of give it a kick in front of him and like take a three-step running charge at it and like look down at the ball to like know where it is, which sort of takes time. Like he can't just all of a sudden quickly whip in a pass. If if he's carrying the ball with his feet and he sees a pass, he can't just do it. But what I was saying was, you know, Dalot's got a lot of flaws defensively, and Ten Hag, like every other manager, is more concerned. And like, that's why Aaron and Case were talking about rest defense. It's the number one thing on managers' minds is always defense. That's why Alejandro Garnacho does not play as often as he does, is because he doesn't defend. He can't. That's why Rashford was moved to striker a lot, because he doesn't do a lot of defensive work. And that's the number one thing on managers' minds is defending. And Dalot is a little weak there, but like either way, Dalot got a new contract. If the split, Dalot was signed 1 year before Wan-Bissaka. So essentially, how many years had it been? Four last year? Yeah, like 4 years later, he got a new contract. So this will be Wan-Bissaka 4 years, 5 years, whatever it is. Same time frame. If the split is anything like it was last year, it's impossible to see Wan-Bissaka not getting a new contract.
Yeah, he's got 2 years left on his current deal. One of those is a plus one option, which you imagine they would trigger. And also, I mean, Wan-Bissaka and Dalot, I believe, are on almost identical wages now since Dalot's extension, which, I mean, even if this is not an ideal right back situation, you know, you're not going to compare this to the rest of the Premier League top clubs in terms of, you know, you can reliably create chances from right back at Man United. But for a team that has other needs to address, it's a pretty nice situation for the next couple of years, I think.
I disagree with that. See, but that's the weird thing is I think you're very close to addressing a lot of the situations you had to do this year. Mm-hmm. Goalkeeper, striker, midfielder. You need another midfielder, but that might be Kaby Manu. Maybe. And if it is Kaby Manu, you don't need another midfielder. In which case, so next year becomes if Hojlund, whatever.
I looked it up. It is Rasmus Højlund.
Højlund. If Højlund is your guy, you don't need a big time striker next year. In which case, what do you need? You probably need a center back because at that point, you need to replace Varane at that point.
Right.
After next year.
Honestly,
it'll be 3 years. But also at that point, Maguire or Lindelof are gone.
Yeah.
And you know, you're getting a center back. You're like the other scenario is right back because ultimately, even if you combined Juan Bissaka and Dalot into one player, I don't think that player is good enough on the ball for what Erik ten Hag wants to do. So you need someone better than Dalot and you need someone better than Juan Bissaka. But if the breakdown is anything like this, it's impossible to see. Like if Juan Bissaka keeps playing as much or just slightly less than Dalot, it's impossible. Like the way that this club runs, you have to think a contract is coming. And he'll get a new contract. If you've got two right backs under contract like that, you're not going to go and sign a third.
I think that's where, I mean, yes, I agree with you. When I say that I think this is a nice situation to have for the next couple of years, that is with the assumption that this is sort of like how we discussed McFred, which is at some point you need to be better than this.
If they take a step forward this year, then at some point has to be very quickly. Like, because all right, right now, the way that the squad is composed, you have, Christian Eriksen is better than McFred, but he's not good. So you still need someone more than that as midfield. Or McTominay might leave. But either way, like this year, you should still get another midfielder who is better than the two of them. And next year, you should get another midfielder who is better than the two of them. And if one of them does leave, you're back to kind of square one because you have four midfielders. So unless Kaby Manu is actually going to play minutes, unless there's going to be a game where Erik ten Hag goes, I know it's the Champions League, but we're playing Spartak Rotterdam or whatever. I'm going to sit Casemiro and actually let Kaby Manu play, or we've got to play PSG on Wednesday and we're playing Nottingham Forest this week. I'm going to let Kaby Manu play against Nottingham Forest, unless that's actually happening. Like if Manu's just there for when Casemiro gets injured or suspended, you're not really utilizing the depth of your team and you need to get better players then.
Yeah. Honestly, though, Pauly,
if this team takes a step forward, then it becomes where are the missing pieces? And the team is only going to take a step forward if Rashford continues his production, Højlund is good, Antony, you know, does what Antony's supposed to do and isn't, you know, contributing four goals in the season. Antony, the jury's... it's not like an absurd statement. You get a year. It's his first year in the league. He now knows what to expect. It's year two. Now it's time to perform. And it's totally reasonable to say he might. And it's totally reasonable to say, well, he might not. But if those things happen and you take a step forward, okay, well, you have Ahmad, you have Garnacho, you have Sancho would probably leave. So what are you looking at in terms of bolstering the team? You probably need a backup to Bruno. You need depth at center back, but the missing piece is going to be like your worst. When you look at, say, who's the worst player on the field here, it's going to be that right back. That's the spot that needs to be upgraded. And if Wan-Bissaka continues to be the guy over Dallo, how would you not give him a contract? And if he gets a contract, how are you signing a new right back? And that could be the Achilles heel. And if there are other areas that the team needs to address, that's sort of a big problem, because that means you spent a lot of money on Antony and he's not performing, or Hoyland didn't perform, and now you really need to blow the bank on a striker. But also, doing that after 1 year of a 20-year-old striker, kind of a dumb decision, because it might take him a year. Like Darwin Nunez, I expect him to have a much better year this year. It was always going to take a year to settle in. Rashford, well, you just gave him a new 5-year contract on £300,000 a week.
And and in that situation, the help that you got him has not paid off.
Yeah.
Yeah. My question I was going to ask you was, do you actually think that we take a big step forward this year?
Oh, that's a very tough question.
Yeah.
That's
the million-dollar question. Because I think as of right now, we're still kind of hovering in the range of top four team, make some cup finals. I don't really see... unless... Because I'm expecting Liverpool to bounce back. I think Dominic Szoboszlai is a potentially, you know, game changer for them in terms of midfield. They also signed Alexi McAllister, who is, I don't know if he's going to be, you know, the level that maybe some people thought he was when he was, you know, off the back of the World Cup win, but he's a really good player and he's young and he's not going to, you know, blow his legs out like Jordan Henderson and Fabinho. I expect Liverpool to be back up there, potentially challenging for the title. I expect Arsenal to still be decent. I don't think Chelsea are going to be that good. But I think that potentially them and Spurs are going to be at least organized this year, as opposed to, you know, whatever they ended last year on.
Okay. So every year since like 2019, I've written a preview other than the Ronaldo year. And this, I've written a preview about United are going to be all right. And it's based on, while everybody focused, while all United fans went into the season panicking, oh, we're terrible and we didn't sign this player. And I was like, well, guess what? We have flaws, but the other teams have flaws too. And we're fine. Like, Chelsea's got problems. Spurs have problems. Don't worry. We're fine. We're one of the top four teams in the league. And each one of those three seasons, we finished in the top four. This year, it seems like everybody's right. Oh, we got better. And you have to remember that we are not a 76-point team or 75-point team. However many we've got, is we overachieved to get there. And you need to get better just to get back to that. I don't want to give too much away for when I write this piece, if I write this piece, so I will give some away.
Go back and look at the goals for and goals against from last season.
Right. And this team, yeah, they underachieved against their XG. But I like go on to the Buzzbee Babe and type in like, my name and statistical analysis, I broke it down, is the games where they underachieved or games where they won. Is those games where they drew 0-0 and 1-1 and or lost 1-0, in a lot of them, they didn't underachieve. They didn't create much. They didn't get much. And yeah, maybe De Gea lost them that West Ham match, but De Gea also made a bunch of ridiculous saves in that match. So sure, Onana doesn't give up that goal 7 minutes into the match, but perhaps he concedes a different one. Like, at the end of the day, West Ham deserved to have one goal in that match, and United deserved a little bit less. So you also need to remember they won all five games. Like, and United also greatly overachieved against on their expected goals against. And that wasn't because of De Gea, who conceded more goals than was expected. So that means that that's your opponents aren't scoring as they're just missing the net. They're not scoring as many as were expected. They're missing the net. Factor in that against Brentford, against Liverpool, and against Manchester City, those three matches where they conceded 13, 17 goals, their XG in those was like six. Their expected goals against was like six. So they really overachieved on their expected goals against, which means the fact that United came out well ahead on the other side just shows how in all the other games, their opponents were terrible finishing and how lucky they got there. So you really need to improve that to get back to where you were. You need to create more chance. It's not just about finishing the chances you got. You need to create more chances. That 0-0 game against Newcastle, you need to create more chances so that you are worthy and deserving of a goal. And if you create more chances, you'll get one. And that game will end 1-0. So it's about finding games where you flip the result and remember that you won't, you know, people sort of made this mistake after 2019-20 when they were like, look at how well we did against the top six. We beat Chelsea twice. We beat City twice. We took a point off of Liverpool. We took 4 points off of Spurs. And it's like, yeah, that's probably not going to happen again. You might have success, and they did have success the following year, but they drew Chelsea twice. They did not get any points, or they got 1 point against Liverpool again, but they drew City once. So you won all five games. You know, maybe you get points in the away games against the top six that you lost all of them last year, except for the draw against Spurs. Maybe you get a few more points there, but winning all those home games is not going to be easy either. And you can't expect to win all of them. Expect to drop some points there. So now you got to make up those points somewhere else. I do. So I'm right there with you. Top four side. Top four side can make deep runs in the cup finals, in the cups. Can also get bounced from the cups early. You know, if the wrong thing happens, you get a wrong draw. Draw an away game.
Give us that Inter Milan Champions League draw.
Right. Who knows what happens if you get a cup draw away from home. I do think, regardless, I am not sure that they finish in the Champions League spots. But regardless of that, I think they're closer now to competing for a title next year, regardless. I do think, yeah. Liverpool, I think, are almost a lock to be back. The Liverpool, the second half of the season, showed that. Like, this was a Liverpool struggle because they got nothing from Darwin Nunez, and they were, but that was always supposed to be a season where he's just settling in. They were a team in transition. And in the second half of the season, they started to figure it out, and now they've made further moves, and I hate it, but I love how the moves that Liverpool have made.
Right.
And
they completely
rebuilt the team, which is what they needed to do. And but they were also really good last year. The results just weren't going their way. And for a team that was completely done and dusted in February, they made United sweat it out until 3 days before the end of the season. They were out of it. It was like, you need to win every single game. And they almost went and did it. And that is more indicative of the team. Like, Liverpool's form in 2023 is far more indicative of what we're going to get next season than their form on the whole season. So it's very likely they're going to be back.
They did that to end the 2021 season as well.
Exactly. I mean, they were back the next
really
year.
Strong, and they almost won the league. They almost won the quadruple the next year.
Yeah. I think Arsenal, I'm on the fence about Arsenal. I think Arsenal either really, they take a step forward and push City like right down to the wire, or they're like, winning a game on the final day of the season to finish fourth. Like, I don't see them finishing like 7-8 points back of City. Like, yeah. It's either like we're right behind City or we are down in fourth.
I think if they can get back to the kind of mechanical form, you know, just maybe not beating all the big teams, but to start last year, they beat everyone else. And that was huge.
They lost both games against City, and it's like, if you draw one of those, it's a different story. But then they also like lost three games,
right?
Like, they dropped points three games in a row against teams that you can't drop points to. And that's the difference.
They fucked it up. They did a bad job to finish the season. If that has like a significant effect on them, because, you know, like, mentality is impossible to really measure. If Arsenal are able to shake that end to last season, I think that they'll be fine. But that was a really serious stumble at the end. Like,
yeah. And it goes one of two ways. Either it carries over and then they're battling for fourth, or it's, you come back refreshed and you learned from it. And then they're ready to mount that challenge, which arguably is what happened to Liverpool. That's exactly what happened to Liverpool. Liverpool pushed City to the end. They finished on 97 points, but there was that stretch in March where they drew United 0-0. They drew two other teams, and that cost them the title. And then they went back and they lost their first game in March. And like they had like one, and their only other, they dropped points in two games before COVID. Two games. So, you know, that got their heads on right. So it could go either way for Arsenal. Spurs, European team at best, not a Champions League team. Chelsea, same thing. The question is,
I guess, Newcastle.
What is Newcastle? How much do they improve? I don't think you're getting as much as you got from Callum Wilson, but I think you get more from Alexander Isak. And
honestly, he didn't even need a year in the Premier League. He needed like 5 months and then he was on it.
do they get do they open up and be more expansive, or are they still going to master the dark arts and be Atletico Madrid again and just be impossible to concede against and just rack up points that way? Newcastle drew a ton of games last year. If they turn any of those into wins, United are in big trouble.
Yeah. All right. I think that was a pretty good first official episode of the season. So we are going to be in New York City this weekend with Nathan. I'm undecided as to whether I'm going to try and record anything while we're there. It would just be like on my phone having a conversation with, maybe Brent. We may not do that. We may record the week after. I don't know. We'll see what the vibe is on the day, but we're excited about that.
I think our issue is that we don't have recording equipment.
Yeah, no, it would have to be on like my phone. It would just be like a voice memo, a 40-minute long voice memo. But yeah, we'll have more content coming out.
We'll be
regularly
in the parking lot. Yeah. The three of us will be in the parking lot with Brent before the game at MetLife Stadium. We'll be in Lot G with everybody else. So
yeah, we'll be
come hang out and see us.
We'll be a little buzzed, maybe. We'll see what the vibe is.
Colin and Nathan are taller than you think. Or Colin is.
Yeah, over 6 foot. I wasn't lying. But yeah, we'll be there. I'm also going to be in the Vegas game.
And I'm going to have to hang out with you. My wife's going to be there. You're going to tower over her.
It's okay. I'm also big. I'm not a threat. I'm a nice guy. I'm a fun hang.
I'm a loud person. You'll hear me.
Yeah. I'll also be at the Vegas game for United Dortmund, and we're going to be doing more preseason content as well as, obviously previews. I'm hoping as well, I haven't organized this a whole lot yet, but to maybe get some opposition view episodes before the season starts. So maybe reaching out to other SB Nation writers from other blogs and getting sort of half-hour conversations on what the other big teams have done this summer and comparing that with United. So hopefully we will have a lot more content coming your way. I know we've been off for a few weeks, but it has been needed, I would say. So thank you for listening as always, and we'll see you next time.